The Foreign Area Officer podcast is not an official audio production. The views shared in the recordings are the personal views of the interviewee and the host. They are for informational purposes only and not necessarily those of the Department of Defense or its components. The United States Department of Defense and the United States Army make no endorsement of its content. Hello, everyone. This is Michael Hill with the Foreign Area Officer Podcast. Today, my guest is Major Neil Law. A native of Queens, New York, Neil currently serves as a U.S. Army Foreign Area Officer in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. He received his commission as a transportation officer from SUNY Albany and completed two deployments to Afghanistan before assessing into the FAO career field and completing in-region training in Mexico City. He is fluent in Chinese Mandarin, Chinese Cantonese, and Spanish. Now, Neil, Haiti is one of the few, if not the only, high-threat posts here in Latin America, and you've been there for about a year now. How has that been to work in a high-threat post that has essentially been on complete lockdown since the day you got there?
Yeah. Hey, Michael, thank you. I see that we are starting off with some of the harder questions. But first and foremost, though, I do want to express my gratitude to you for putting this together and for hosting me. And also just to further expound a little bit on my background, just for our target audience, so they have an idea of where I am in my timeline in my career. As you said, Michael, this is my first FAO assignment. This is part of my utilization tour post-grad school. Before that, I had completed WINSEC, IRT, and language training, which it's all there as part of my bio. And then for our non-target audience, this is just part of our military career timeline. And I'll actually provide a little bit more details later on. So, Michael, going back to your question, high threat post here in Haiti, here working as the Army Attaché in Port-au-Prince. Things and times are definitely challenging. We are several months into what we call order departure, as there were some security incidents that happened earlier this year that has triggered order departure. And what that means is that a lot of our family members, as well as non-mission essential personnel, were told to go back to the U.S. Until the security situation permits, where we can resume full embassy operations. And to be clear, we are still here. We are still working very closely with our Haitian counterparts through our respective interagency. So for myself, I'm still working very closely with members of the Ministry of Defense, as well as other security partners. It is challenging, but I will say that I work with an excellent team, even though our DoD footprint here is relatively small, but we have great members of the country team, and I think I work arguably with some of the best Department of State Foreign Service officers and other interagency partners.
And that is, I think, the most important part when you're in one of those high threat areas is really relying on the interagency. I visited the Haiti embassy when I was on IRT, goodness, almost 10 years ago, and it's a large embassy. I remember, unless something's changed, USAID owns about half that embassy. So I imagine it's a pretty empty building at this point. How has that been working with the part that stayed to continue to work the mission to keep the embassy going?
Yeah. So we do have still a large presence and a large footprint here. While some of our family members, as I mentioned earlier, had returned to the U.S., we brought in additional personnel to ensure that the mission and our lines of effort that are synced up and aligned with our integrated country strategy. We are still moving towards and accomplishing a lot of those missions and those priorities. And using USAID as an example, they are still working very closely with their, what they call their implementing partners, in ensuring that their projects are still ongoing and still continuing. It is challenging. We did have to scale back some given the security situation. But what we like to tell and what we like to reassure our counterparts is that we are still here. We are still working.
And that's the most important message that we can send in that case, is that we are there. And as soon as we can bring more people in and we can get you guys get the situation under control, we'll be back and we'll start the truck up again and we'll get it rolling again.
Exactly.
In our previous discussion, you'd made the point that it's really important to remember that when we're in another country, we are their guests. We are at their disposition. We're not there to tell them what to do, but to help them in any way that we can.
100%.
In a country that's suffering like Haiti is, that's one of the most important messages that we can send.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I can't imagine that when you sign on and submitted your VTIP packet, you imagined that your first assignment would be in Haiti. What did you think when you saw your first assignment was going to be to Haiti?
I could even backtrack a little bit before that, Michael. Before my assignment to Haiti, even very early on when I first was informed that I was luckily and fortunate enough to be assessed into the foreign area officer community, when I checked my regional or area of concentration to be Latin America, I thought there was a mistake. Because when I first had learned about the FAO community, it was actually while I was stationed in Japan. And I had met my very first foreign area officer there, and he told me that, hey, you seem to be a great fit. You speak multiple languages. And to be quite honest, I had no idea what the FAO community was, what FAOs do or did. So it was enlightening. And then when he explained to me that at least his job there under USERJ, which is U.S. Army Japan, how he as a FAO was acting as a liaison to the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force, which is known as the JGSDF, where he is the interlocutor between the USERJ two-star command there and to the Japanese forces. I thought that was great because it's from how he explained it, quite accurately, he is there on the ground at the implementation level of executing U.S. policy and working very closely with our host nation partners, with our allies, and especially in a critical region such as what we know now as the Indo-Pacific.
Right. So do you remember the name of the guy that was there? Of the FAO that you met?
I do, but I won't bring up his name here. I did not talk to him previously, but I will say he's doing great. And actually, I reached out to him not too long ago. Just occasionally, I'll just send him a message and let him know that, hey, this is where I'm at. And this might be a bit tangential, but I wanted to bring up the topic of mentorship and mentoring.
Yeah, fantastic.
And I'll just simply summarize it in just two words. For those of us that are seeking mentors or even mentorees, simply ask. Just ask the person, ask the officer, and it doesn't even have to be someone within the FAO community. It could be any one of our great colleagues within the interagency. Reach out to them, ask them, and I can almost promise you that they will say yes. And they'll be happy to sit down to answer whatever questions you may have in terms of your career experience. I myself personally have reached out and ensured that I had kept in contact with a lot of the senior leaders within the FAO community and outside the community itself to touch base. I think the times when I had really reached out was when doing assignment cycles, just reaching out to them, asking them what are some of their views and some of their opinions on the location, on the job, and even some of the internal and dynamics of the embassy, of a country team, if that is the place that you're looking for an assignment. And also even some of the combatant commands.
How do you mean even some of the combatant commands? You mean reaching out to the folks that work there?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay. I don't mean by reaching out to the combatant commanders.
if he's your mentor,
if they're your mentor, yes, shouldn't. By all means. And again, I think my assessment still holds true. If you were to reach out to any one of the combatant commanders, I'm sure they will take the time to give you that mentorship, give you their advice.
Probably would, to be honest.
Yeah.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about Japan. What were you doing in Japan at the time? What was your job there? And what was your interaction at the time with the Japanese forces?
That was actually my last assignment prior to assessing into the FAO Corps. So my job there was actually as a logistics officer. I was in charge of what we called APS-4, which is the Army Pre-Positioned Stocks, number 4.
Gotcha.
Just to sum that up as well, that just picture those equipment that we have there on the island of Japan, as well as the equipment that we had in Korea. Those are what we know as the war reserve stocks, if you will. I believe that was its legacy name. That was what it was formerly known. So essentially, all of our lines of effort were focused on the Korean Peninsula, if there were any conflict or a regional outbreak of conflict in that area. We
gotcha.
Had the equipment. We, as the unit that I was with, were in charge of ensuring that they were functional and they were operational, that should, in the event of any conflict, that equipment can be pulled out and ready to use, ready to be used by our warfighters. And my interaction with JGSDF, with the ground, with the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force, was rather limited during that time, during my assignment there.
Okay.
Given our proximity, working closely with them, a lot of them were actually on the base that I was working at, which is known as Camp Zama. We actually were able to give a lot of exchanges or classes or training, if you will, and just informing them of what the equipment was and some of our logistical processes. And I think that also propelled my desire to work not just in the foreign area officer community, but to work abroad. I was able to showcase some of our best practices, albeit during the time it was mostly focused in logistics. But quickly, as I'm sure many of us can attest, whenever we have any type of training or exchanges, it often goes beyond what our doctrine, what our military processes and doctrine says. A lot of it is based on cultural exchanges. And I think that, right, that truly fosters our alliances throughout the world.
I'll be honest, I've been surprised to see how many FAOs learn about the job and become interested in doing the job by going to a different country, whether it be on a deployment or on a TDY, and working with a partner. And they have that experience and they think, man, this would be great if I could do this full time. Being an infantry or an armor or a logistics officer is great, but this is what I want to do. I want to work with foreign partners. And then, and sometimes they happen upon a FAO that were in the same area, or they remember getting a brief when they were young lieutenants or as cadets on the foreign area officer, and that's how I need to do it. So going from Japan was when you started the FAO process. Did you apply to, did you VTIP in Japan?
I VTIP while I was in Japan, yes. Yes.
Okay. How was that transition for you, going from working with a partner in Japan to jumping on to Latin America ship, as it were, and coming across the pond, the side of the world, to the Western Hemisphere? You said you're shocked. I think that what you said was you thought it was a mistake.
I thought it was, yes.
Why did you think it was a mistake to send you to Latin America?
Well, yeah, if I could unpack that. It was, please don't get me wrong.
No, not at all.
I have not since looked back and said, wow, I can't believe I got Latin America. Now, after I was assigned the region and after working here for, even though this is my first official FAO assignment, as we mentioned earlier, I did IRT, which is the in-region training. I spent 1 year in Mexico City working at the U.S. Embassy there, and it has been phenomenal. It has been a phenomenal experience. What I meant by when I thought it was a mistake was simply because of the fact that I had applied while I was in Japan, and I believe I put Asia, Southeast Asia, or East Asia as one of my first area of preference because of the fact that I grew up speaking Chinese.
I've known a lot of people that have thought they were going to get a certain region because of their background or their language experience or their cultural experience. And either they haven't made it into FAO or were given a region that they didn't expect. I had a colleague when I was teaching at West Point, with along with three other colleagues at West Point that applied to be FAO. All of them had regional experience. All of them had language. All they needed was ILE, and they were fully qualified FAOs. All four were denied, incidentally. And I was talking to one. He was a regional expert. He spoke the language. And I said, why do you want to be a FAO? Because I want to speak this language, and I want to live in this country. And I said, but if you apply for FAO and you get Africa, will you keep the job? And he said, no.
Yeah.
I said, what if you get Latin America? I said, no, I only want to go to this country, this region, to speak this language. I said, you don't want to be a foreign area officer. You just want to live and work in that country and speak that language. And there are other jobs that you can do. Mm-hmm. And for those who are thinking of becoming a FAO, I think that's a very valid observation and conversation you need to have with yourself and with your family. Because when you do submit that application, you have no control. I was fortunate that I got my first choice, but it doesn't always happen the way we think it will. So if this is a job that you want to do because you're looking forward to working anywhere in the world and learning any language, this is going to be a great job for you. If you want to only work in a certain region or work with a certain language, this might not be the job for you. And on the other hand, I remember meeting a guy when I went through JFAOC. I think he had grown up in Ukraine, but he spoke Russian, Ukrainian, Moldovan, and he was sent to be a Western Asia FAO. So he was at DLI learning Urdu. And He said, I don't know what I'm doing here. I should be going somewhere else. But they said, that's where the Army needs you. And that's in the end what it needs to be is we are working for the Army and the Army's going to tell us where to go. So all that to say, I completely understand where you're coming from.
Hey, Michael, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a very salient point. And I think for a lot of our new FAOs or perhaps even people that are interested in and considering retipping, I think that's a very important point to keep in mind, that the region that you are offered is your one and only option. And if that's not something that you are interested in or looking forward to, then Unfortunately, that's just how the DA PAM is written now. And going back to your point, too, Michael, one would have to decide if being a FAO is more important than the region that you're living in or that you want to live in. And that was the choice that I made. That was a conscious choice that I wanted to be a foreign air officer, to be able to work with some of our best in the nation, not just within our military, within DOD, but also Department of State, and all to advance U.S. interests, but also align with our host nation and our partners to work toward that common goal, increasing, just expanding and emphasizing our values and our ethics. And I think that's what really called out to me. And that's why, as I said, when I saw Latin America, I was initially taken aback, because even though I had submitted the VTIP while I was in Japan, and I love living in Japan, and also with my Chinese background, with the language, being able to speak Cantonese and being somewhat fluent in Mandarin, I thought, hey, it's gotta be Asia, right? Where else could I work? But I will say, having gone through language training, I think that's where you and I actually crossed paths there at DLI, learning Spanish and then coming down here, working through in the region. I will say, even the challenging times here in Haiti has not made me look back and say, man, did I make a mistake? That thought has never crossed my mind. Because,
that's good.
Because as many of us know, and especially the 48 Rebels, we know how rich and culturally expansive and our deep history from the U.S. to the Latin America region. We share a lot in common, and it is just great. It is just great working here.
I think Latin America, I'm biased. I've spent a lot of time here, but I think it's one of the greatest regions out there. And there's a good reason that a lot of people put it as their first choice.
Yeah.
So what was that transition like for you then, going from Japan into, I think DLI was your first stop on your training?
I believe so. Yes. Yes. If I recall correctly. Yes.
Yeah. And how was that transitioning from being a Chinese speaker to being a Spanish speaker?
Yeah, it was tough. I don't want to complain. I'm sure you recall too, Michael, when we were at DLI, I think Spanish and French were probably arguably some of the easier languages to pick up. Just simply look at the timeline that we were allotted to learn the language. I definitely saw some of my fellow friends and colleagues and peers that were learning Chinese or learning hard languages like Russian, Arabic, even MSA. They look stressed. Whereas for us, I think we had pretty easy. Some easier than most, but no, but to sum up my transition in perhaps 2 points, I would say it was a steep learning curve. And I'm not just talking about the language here. I'm talking about the transition to being a FAO. Me personally, anecdotally, I think there was a steep learning curve for myself. And then I think a bit of hesitancy or reticence. And what I mean by that is when I had first expressed to some of my peers, colleagues, and leadership that I wanted to change over VTIP from my logistics branch, I think some had offered their insight to me in that you would essentially jumping into a new career. You would be starting completely in the new career field. And we also have to keep in mind too, that by the time that we do get assessed, we're between, I would say on average, 8 to 10, a little bit more. There are some exceptions, of course, but 8 to 10 years or so in our original or a regimental branch. And in those years, you've made connections with various leaders and mentors and so many colleagues and junior enlisted soldiers, NCOs that you have worked with. And to leave all that behind, I think can be jarring. I've actually come to learn, quite to my surprise, that's actually a misnomer, because we didn't leave any of that behind, in a sense. I carry forward with me all my logistical experience. And I can even tell you right now, who would have thought that here as an Army attaché, as a FAO here in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, I'm still able to even apply some of my logistical background in some of my work.
Can you expand on how your logistics background has come in handy in Haiti?
Yeah, of course. It's a very timely example. Right now, as we talked earlier about Haiti being a high threat post and then being perhaps a very tumultuous time, we as the interagency, we at POST here are working together with a multinational police effort, what we now know as the Multinational Security Support Mission. It's actually been approved in October of this year of 2023 and what we call the UNSCR, which is the UN Security Council resolution. I believe the number is 2699, and it is led by Kenya. But right, without getting too much into the details of the mission and the planning, as many of us know, especially the logisticians, logistics is a very integral part of this mission planning. And this is where I was able to provide some of my expertise, albeit there is a little bit of gap. I don't know how much the doctrine has changed, but for the most part, I'm still able to apply a lot of my knowledge and background to this process.
That's something, as an aviation officer, I don't get to apply aviation very much to my the FAO job, unless they pick me to go flying in Brazil, but I don't think that's going to happen anymore. And I think that ship has sailed for me. But most of us don't get to practice our branch, but we still have to stay up to date on our doctrine and the policies that are affecting how infantry and armor and logistics and military intelligence operations are being conducted. Particularly because when we transition into FAO, our partner nations don't see us as foreign area officers. You are a logistics officer that's working at the embassy. I am an aviation officer that's working at the embassy, or an infantry officer. So we are still responsible for that body of knowledge and for all of that experience.
That's right.
And so it is incumbent on us to stay current. That transition can be hard, but we cannot leave behind everything that we've done and the experiences that we've had. So throughout that experience, that MUFFOR training pipeline, yes, is there anything you would have done differently? If you could be the king of the FAO for a day, would you change things? Would you shorten it, lengthen, provide more time for grad school, for example, or get a second language? What would you do differently, having relatively recently come out of the pipeline?
That's right. Yeah. To ensure that we don't upset anyone, a proponent.
No. We all have our ideas. Yeah.
I will say the DAPAM 600-3 does lay out very clearly, extensively, the training pipeline. Me personally, I am not advocating for change. What I personally would advocate, and using the scenario that you just gave me, if I was king for a day, I would definitely place an emphasis, and I would ensure that the in-region training opportunity is received throughout the community. And what I mean by that is, ensure that the funding is there. Ensure that when we, at different posts, at different countries, at different embassies, when we do receive a newly assessed foreign area officer, we as leaders grant and foster and allow the young FAOs to be able to go out to do their in-region training. I can't tell you how invaluable that experience was for me while I was in Mexico City, but being able to travel throughout the region and understanding the nuances and the complexities of each of the countries, or as many countries as you can, of your specific region. And even how they view us as the U.S. as a country and their relationships. There are some longstanding relationships with U.S. DOD, and some perhaps may be more of a newer initiative. But in order for us as regional experts to be able to truly understand that, I am definitely an advocate for the in-region training, that portion of the training pipeline. I don't know if you would agree with that.
I agree with that. IRT, there are a lot of ways we can do it. Every region is different. Every region does their IRT in a different fashion. Europe aggregates their FAOs to most of their FAOs to one location. Most other regions are spread out. And even within the regions, there are different methods for doing IRT at the embassies. I remember when I was going through IRT, I talked to some of my fellow FAOs, and one of them was told, Michael, upon arrival, you will do 6 months in the office, and then you will do 6 months of travel. But for those first 6 months, you will not travel outside of this country. Another FAO was told by his raider, senior raider, I don't know who it was, I do not think that IRT is an important use of the Army's money. Therefore, you will not travel while you are on IRT, and your OER is going to reflect how you perform your duties in the office. So do not expect to travel during your 12 months here in country. I, in Brazil, was told, your job is to travel, to get to know the region, to get out of the country, to get around this country and see and experience everything there is to do. So it really is interesting that even though we have an experience that's supposed to be similar across the board, is different across regions and is different within regions. Now, what, did you have any experiences on IRT that, that were defining for you or that you think were valuable as part of your IRT experience?
I do want to share two notable experiences. I'll start with the serious one and then I'll probably have a funny story.
Okay.
But the first, when I was doing my portfolio as a narcotics officer working in the Office of Defense Coordination, and I had the opportunity to go down to Barranquilla in Colombia. And believe it or not, that was my first time in Colombia. 3 days into the conference, the president of Colombia actually showed up and attended the event. He made some opening remarks and closing about wanting to continue a lot of the initiatives with the U.S. and as well as other multinational efforts and countries. But one thing I was able to take away from that conference, I was able to bring back a lot of those ideas to Mexico City, and we were actually able to solidify a comprehensive monitoring plan. It was a trilateral agreement, I believe, between Mexico, Colombia, and us as the U.S., where we were able to increase, I believe I can talk about this now, it was to increase some of the monitoring capabilities that we have at each of the different points of the border to ensure that, and at the time, which it is still now, I believe, the focus was fentanyl.
Okay.
An uptick in traffic
right.
from the southern border. I will say, anecdotally, there is a funny story that even some of my fellow peers to this day will still very kindly remind me of. I will leave out the name of the country in the event that they are offended, but I will tell you the country off. You have plenty of experience there. This was definitely, it could have turned into a faux pas. I definitely think it was a mistake on my part, but it was during one of my IRT travels. It was with the group. So there was about 6 or 7 of us, and we were being escorted. We were taken to this one, I can't recall now specifically if it was their version of the War Academy or the military school. But regardless, it was a very nice place. It was a very prestigious area, and it was raining that day. So we had just stepped out of our vehicles and then just being guided into this building, which looked like a museum. And I don't know what possessed me to do this, but as soon as we walked in, my boots were a little wet, and I see this rug that's just laying out there in the middle of this area. And I guess the guy that had walked me in may have been, this is just my excuses now, may have been blocking this little, it was like a rope to prevent people from walking all over this rug and this tapestry. But I decided to go over there and scuff my boots all over it because, again, it was raining outside. And as I'm scuffing, one of the guides there said, please step off of our commemorative. It's one of their battles of like their independence. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, I felt horrible. Needless to say, for the rest of that tour and my time there, I was just trying to shy away and just shrink into the background. But to this day, they still remind me of that. I believe they have put a bigger rope to ensure that people don't make the same mistake.
Now they got a full cord on, someone there to constantly tell people.
Exactly.
Oh, that's great. It's funny. But to be honest, that's one of the reasons that IRT is there too. We don't often have interactions with other governments, other militaries, and we might not understand what can be important to them. And it's better to make those mistakes as an internist, basically it's what we are, working in the embassy, than as a permanently assigned diplomat and then have to live with that for the rest of the time that you're there. But is it better to make that mistake? If you're going to make it, it's better to make it when you're there for a TDY than when you're PCS there, because that creates some problems. So I wanted to transition now to something you had mentioned before. IRT experiences, I think, are very formative for us as foreign area officers across the board. But I know that each one of us has a defining moment and that sort of propels us on our current trajectory, whether it be as a foreign area officer or as an officer in general. And you and I had discussed previously an experience you had recently during your promotion, which I think was about a year ago, and in an unusual place and maybe in an unusual way compared to what most officers experience. Would you mind talking about that a little bit?
Of course. I was lucky enough to be selected as a major. And it was fulfilling in that I was able to hold the ceremony at Ground Zero of the World Trade Center, right by the reflecting pool. Reason why that, obviously, like for many of us, reason why that location held importance to me was because 9/11 was what had propelled me to join in the service. And being born and raised in New York during that time, I think I was, if I recall correctly, I was around 12 to 13 years old. I was still in school and then subsequently being taken out. And of course, that day was seared into my memory. I also had two cousins that worked in the building or worked in World Trade Center during that time. And fortunately enough, they were both able to escape without any physical injuries. Although one of my cousins, whose name I will not share here publicly, but I know that she does carry some level of trauma or PTSD to this day, understandably so. The reason why I was able to say that I was able to bring it back full circle is because I was able to do it right there in the reflecting pool, had my family there, and even had the pleasantry of asking the battalion commander of the New York City recruitment battalion, who was actually stationed out at Fort Hamilton. I actually invited her to come out to promote me. Unbeknownst to me, but during her speech, as she was making some remarks, she mentioned that her aunt was actually one of the United 93 passengers on the United flight that, as we all know, crashed in Pennsylvania. It was, of course, a very somber moment for many of us. In that moment, as I was sharing a few of my words with my friends and family, my two cousins were there. I think I had said something to the extent of this, excuse me, getting a little choked up here myself too. 20 years later, here we stand all together, even though 9/11 on that day had united us in grief. We stood there that day, united in service and in gratitude. And believe it or not, fast forward to this year, to 2023, here I am working at the U.S. Embassy here in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. I bump into someone who actually had served as a police officer during 9/11. And there was even a picture taken of him where he was helping a young lady get to safety. And this was after, I believe, one of the buildings had collapsed and you could just tell they were just covered. I wanted to emphasize this point that there's a lot of people that we work with, that we will work with. And really all it takes is just to strike up a conversation with any one of them, and you will be able to hear their story, and it's remarkable. I equate this to there are just so many heroes that just walk among us, very humble, very quiet.
Very true.
It's not until you get to talk to them when you really get to know a little bit about their story. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to share this here, Michael.
No, I appreciate you sharing part of your story. It's those defining moments that really make us who we are, and they get rolled up into who we are as officers, who we are as soldiers. And they really are the foundation for who we are as leaders as well. Mm-hmm. How has that experience played into your leadership philosophy in your KD commands and your leadership experiences, or even now as a FAO?
Now, in terms of leadership philosophy, I do have to, these were things that I have done, but it wasn't until I had the very fortunate opportunity to sit down with General Brooks when he was the U.S. Forces Korea four-star commander. At the time when this was also my time in Japan, I actually had the opportunity to sit down with him for lunch. It wasn't just me, of course. It was a group of us. But in that conversation, he very happily shared his philosophy, his leadership philosophy. And he called it the three L's, which is listen, learn, and lead. I believe, if I recall correctly, those were the three L's. If he happens to listen to this and I happen to get one of them wrong, please, my apologies. But he had explained that as any young junior officer, junior leader, really for anyone, and this is where I believe it truly applies, it can be applied to us as young FAOs, especially not just working on country teams or at combatant commands or even some of the institutional jobs that we will all hold. But when you first get into any location, listen to the people that are there. I know General Brooks put it in more of a mentorship for junior officers, new lieutenants coming in. And his advice was listen to your NCOs. And I can translate that into for those of us that are coming onto a country team, like in my case, listen to the folks that have been there, that are working here. And it even goes beyond some of our country team members, not just the fellow Americans that you work with side by side, but even the local staff. I would advocate even more so that you need to talk with the local staff because they are here. They are living in this country. In my case here, the Haitian locally employed staff, they have a wealth of knowledge. I think we just had one person retired. He spent 40 years here. Just they have seen all kinds of people come through the embassy, all types of policies that we have tried to enact, some with success, some with failures. But listen to them and then learn from them, right? That's the second L. And then the third, you know what General Brooks said, was to finally, once you have a good understanding, is to lead. And leading, of course, can vary in different meanings, different definition. You mentioned as a logistics officer, as an S4, you can lead your shop. For us as FAOs, we can definitely lead the different offices that we work in, whether that's a pole mill, a political military advisor to the WHA, or even in your specific country team, you can lead that section by being an expert, being that regional expert that we are we're expected to be. I was actually bold enough, if you could believe it or not, I actually offered a fourth L to General Brooks in that luncheon. And I told him, I said, I think the fourth L would, to some degree, would be love, like to love what you do. Now I know that's
great.
That's not preordained. That's not prescribed. That's not something that we have to do. I know, you know, I think if we ask any number of our colleagues, do you love your job? Do you love your work? You know, as many of us are just clacking away behind a desk and clacking away at a keyboard. Some may say, no, I don't love this job. But for me personally, I do get to come in every day working at the U.S. Embassy, working so closely with our partners and with the host nation and just advancing, again, not just U.S. interests, but the interests of the country that we are working in and working with, and just fostering that ally, that alliance, and the bilateral relationship that we have.
I think you are on point with that fourth L. So I think you can safely say that this is now your leadership philosophy because you changed 25% of it. So you can safely say that it's yours. I would say not just loving your job, but also loving the people you work with, mm-hmm. and the people that you're leading and the people that you're working for. Because when you have that love for the things that you're doing and the people you're working with, it makes you work that much harder to accomplish the mission. Mm-hmm. It makes it that much easier to do your job and makes it much more valuable when you accomplish your goals as a group and as a team.
That's right. That's right.
I think that's a great philosophy. Listen, learn, lead, and Neil Law is adding love to those three, to now the four L's of his leadership philosophy. I wanted to close out now discussing books. Now, you and I had talked about books in the past when we were at JFAOC a little bit, mm-hmm. about the things we were reading that were important. And before we started recording, we were talking about a couple books that you recommend that have either influenced the way you do your job as a FAO or that have been pivotal to your understanding of the world. Mm-hmm. One of them was The Ugly American, and that's one I've seen on a lot of lists.
Yes.
So why that book? Why The Ugly American?
Quite frankly, until I had gone to the JFAOC, which is the Joint Foreign Area Officer Orientation Course, which is a 2-week orientation held in Monterey, California at DLI, that I believe was one of the first books that one of the guest speakers had recommended, or it may have came out on a list. Okay. And it was a short read. But I thought that despite it being a small book and a short read, I thought that it had significantly influence my view, my perspective, and has greatly influenced how I apply myself as a leader and how I work as a FAO. And the reason why that is because it not giving any spoilers away, because I definitely do recommend all FAOs just picking up this book, reading it. Promise you'll get over it and you'll finish it in just a day. But it shows the dichotomy of, one, an ugly American, hence the title of the book, and then what an American should do that's right, especially in the arena of foreign policy, being a guest in a country. You have two really perfectly clear examples. Of course, the ugly American is the person that's loud and boisterous coming into a country and just demanding certain things to be a certain way with zero consideration of what the other country or the host nation really wants or need. And I just, it's been a while since I've read it now, so please forgive me if the details are hazy, but also recall that the ugly American, the antagonist, if you will, did not speak the local language, coming in with that sort of stereotypical American arrogance. This is going to be my way. And you saw some of the ripple effects. I think the backdrop of the ugly American was of the Vietnam War. And I think now we can look back in hindsight and see how disastrous some of the policies were back then. And I think that book just really encapsulates what one should do and what one shouldn't do.
I'll admit that I have not read that one yet. And I know it is on almost every region's and the general FAO reading list.
Yeah.
So I'll make a point to put it on as the next book I get. Mm-hmm. You mentioned another book called The Sympathizer by Viet Nguyen.
Yes.
I'd never heard of this book. So I wonder if you could tell me why this book for you is something that changed the way you see the world.
Yeah, of course. It was, I have not heard about this either. It was also recommended to me by one of my fellow peers, colleagues. So it, oddly enough, the book, The Sympathizer, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, I forget which year, also takes place at the backdrop of the Vietnam War, actually at the end of the Vietnam War. And again, not giving the book away nor any spoilers, if you will. I thought this book was interesting in the fact that there's obviously a lot of topics and nuances here. But perhaps most strikingly is that it is how someone from Vietnam, so a Vietnamese, how they view America and Americans. So I thought that was very interesting. And the reason why the book is called The Sympathizer is because there's this one person who's obviously Vietnamese, was sympathetic to the communist cause, to the Communist Party, to the North Vietnamese at the time. But yet he was also working as a double agent. He was embedded in South Vietnam with one of the top ranking officers. So this person saw both sides, both causes, if you will. Mm. And then interestingly enough, the duality of the protagonist is that this person is also half, I believe, half French and half Vietnamese. He was able to really even embody the duality of his vision, of his view, and he was able to even personify that. But again, I think the main takeaway for this book was, interestingly, how he viewed America. And I think that speaks volumes for us, because as we go forward in our career as FAOs, it's important for us to be mindful and to understand how the host nation or our allies, and in some cases our adversaries, competitors, how they view us. So that's why I also do highly recommend this book. And again, I by no means am I a Vietnam War expert. It just so happened that this was the latest book that I read, and just happy to share that.
No, that's great. I think the Vietnam era and that experience in Vietnam was a pivotal moment for the U.S. Army and for the DoD in general. It was a watershed of experience and lessons learned, mm-hmm. and really shaped our national policy and our policy towards conflict abroad for the ensuing 50 to 60 years. I think it still has an effect on the American psyche and the psyche of the United States Army. Even though the events that it refers to are on the past now, it still makes a big difference for everything that we do today. Mm-hmm. So thank you for recommending those. I will definitely put both of those books on my list. And I thought it was interesting to note that the common theme between both of those books was seeing the other side, mm-hmm. and not just seeing it, but experiencing it and trying to understand how the other side sees us as the United States,
yes.
and even more so as U.S. military officers.
That's correct.
Understanding their viewpoint is going to do worlds to help us understand how we can interact with them to help accomplish our goals and the goals of the integrated country strategy or the lines of effort of the COCOM that we're working in. So thank you for sharing those. That's fantastic.
Of course.
Well, Neil, I really appreciate the conversation today. It's been fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off here?
Yes, I actually do have one closing remark, and I just wanted to you know, applaud you for really applying this or sharing with me some of your prompts and some of your questions. But one that really jumped out at me and that I do want to share in closing is you had asked, how does my story or how does my career path, how is it unique? And my initial humble reaction was to answer, it's really not all that unique. But then when I really took some time to really think it through, I was like, you know what, it actually is. And it's, and I consider myself very fortunate, not just to have had the opportunities that I had, that put me here today. But it's really, I want to highlight, it's the people that I've had the opportunity to serve with and serve alongside. And I can think back to my early days as a young lieutenant. I've had excellent NCOs, junior enlisted soldiers, commanders, to my time now as a FAO with many interagency partners. As I mentioned earlier, the Foreign Service officer are arguably some of the most educated and best diplomats within the Department of State that advance our values and really embody them. And then, of course, I can't overlook our multinational partners, as we talked all throughout this podcast, is, you know, how we work together with them and how we work hand in hand with them. And I've met many during my time throughout my IRT and even my time at Winsight. And lastly, I want to say, I might be a little bit of a nerd here, but I do relate a little bit, and I am reminded of the Iliad and the Odyssey written by Homer, stories of Achilles.
Yeah, classics.
Yeah, classics. Yeah. Stories like Achilles that stood the test of time. And I remember in one excerpt, I forget who the person was speaking, but had mentioned that he felt like he was standing on the shoulders of giants. That was a reference to Achilles. And I truly feel that way because of the amazing caliber of people that I've had the opportunity to work with, such as yourself here, Michael, and have had the opportunity to even cross paths with, albeit briefly when I was in Mexico City, but even a Medal of Honor recipient. It truly makes me feel like I am an NPC in some ways, a non-playable character. I do feel that way sometimes, but I am just constantly surrounded by greatness. And I try to take a bit from each person that I happen to cross paths with, and I make it my own, kind of what we had covered earlier with the leadership philosophy. In closing, I just want to thank you again here, Michael, especially taking the time away from your family, but I just wanted to say this has been an excellent and great opportunity, and I encourage other Foreign Air Officers to come forward and to take part in this excellent podcast. So thank you.
No, thank you, Neil. And likewise, I think you're a great leader and great professional, and I look forward to working with you in the future and to seeing where your career takes you. I know you're going to do great things for the Foreign Air Officer community, and I'm glad to be a part of your career and be a part of your story. And I look forward to seeing you again soon, and hopefully we'll find you downrange.
Thank you.